Now I just want to conclude what we started last time. I said many things in words. I didn't write anything down, so I wanted to write down a few of those things that they are written somewhere. And then we will move on to the last part, and yeah, I will introduce it when we get there. Last thing we looked at was this ADM phase space for GR, which is like an off-shell canonical phase space. And the variables are the metric on the Cauchy surface and some conjugate momentum. So the geometric interpretation, which is given in a sense a posteriori, as we will see, geometric interpretation of pi is given by the Legendre transform pi ij equal the root of h extrinsic curvature minus kind of a trace part. And the relevant thing to remember here is that kij is essentially the lead derivative in the normal direction of hij. But to express these, I need a notion of normal derivative, which is not present on sigma. So this is why I say a posteriori, because to be able to talk about this, I need to have like a spacetime picture, which is not here, not yet there. So a posteriori, because on the ADM, there is no space-time, just space. So until we solve the dynamics, in a sense, we cannot talk about the space-time. Okay, so what is this dynamics? Well, in the case of GR, it is kind of completely intertwined with the symmetries, as we saw many times, in many different forms. So we saw this when we discussed Lovelock theorem. We saw this also like in Jacobson's formulation, in a sense, because we saw that these formulas, this force law, are related to diffeomorphism invariants in somehow, but they're also enough to reconstruct things. But I would say Lovelock is the strongest, and also a theorem that I will cite in a moment. So dynamic and symmetries are encoded in the Dirac's hypersurface deformation algebra. And I put algebra in quotes because, as we saw, we don't have structure constants as an algebra has by definition, but rather structure functions, which kind of take us away from this standard algebraic setting of gauge theories. So what is this hypersurface deformation algebra, which I will call HDA? Later on is the following. And I apologize if I get the sign wrong. I forgot to double check it again. and HN Chem is equal to V of Z, where Z, important thing is that is Z is equal to HIJ and DJ. And the crucial guy is this A. Yes?
Just to be clear again, when you say there is no space-time, just space until we solve theta,
mm-hmm.
does this have to do with what we said right at the beginning with identifying the whole trajectory?
In a sense, yes. I would say even more naively, without going into trying to understand the dynamics for the moment, what I mean is that in here, I have a three metric and a conjugate momentum. There's no notion of directions outside of sigma anywhere. So this is just a tensor density on sigma. And this is as much as is written here. So it's very little, in fact. There's nothing. We have just these, and we have a flow in this space generated by V and H. So we have these two flows. So, but that's it. We are not yet able to say that this is a spacetime. So how would a spacetime emerge from this picture? Is to say, have a series of sigmas, and as I move from one to the other, the metric changes in a certain way. And this is what the spacetime is. No, it's a stack of these sigmas, a foliation, and on each of them I have to identify a certain metric. In fact, it's not quite enough. I also need to say how to go from one to the other. But in the phase space per se, there's nothing like this. So to be able to reconstruct a dynamics, I need to say how to build this stack of H. But at this level, there's nothing. So once I have one of these nice flows, like these nice orbits of H and V, well, mostly of H, I can use it to, and I can interpret it as a spacetime, because it tells it. I will get there in a moment. So if the question is still relevant in a few minutes, you ask it again. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, I will write them again. So here, what are these things? Well, the general 4D diffeomorphism was, so let me rather say it the other way around. X is a vector field on sigma. So vector field, so it's an infinitesimal diffeo of sigma. This is what this x is, and Vx is the generator. I will write it in a second. And n is just a function on sigma, and is called the lapse. So the geometric interpretation, again, a posteriori though, for the same reason as before, posteriori geometric interpretation is my four-dimensional diffeo is x plus n. So there is a tangent part of the diffeo and the normal part. This is a 4D infinitesimal diffeo. Tangent to sigma and normal to sigma. But again, is an a posteriori interpretation. Is how we constructed this, coming from spacetime. But if we try to think in a purely canonical way, in a 3+1 way, our phase space just knows about the three dimensions. And so we don't have a spacetime. There's no n in here. We could try to add it. Some people did that. but in this standard formulation, it's just h. So there's no normal direction, nothing like that, and therefore it's just space. So now we can write V explicitly. So Vx, I write it as, I change slightly notation from last time to simplify things a bit. N times H. So I introduce just these densities, and Vi is the 3D divergence of pi. So this looks a lot like the Gauss constraint, as we said. We also said that one has to be careful because this is a density, so it's not just a tensor. There are extra terms in the definition of this divergence that come from pi being a density. So it's just something to keep in mind if one does an explicit computation. And h is this. This is the 3D Ricci scalar of H. So this is just of H minus. There might be a 1/2 somewhere. So there is an H up here because this must be a density. It's integrated over sigma, and this is just a scalar. And here it's downstairs because pi is a density. So this is a weight 2 density. So I have to remove. Divide by it. Okay, so this is it. And now let me call these two equations together star, because I will refer them in my remarks. So we write a lot of words right now, and so just bear with me. Instead of just saying things that get a bit lost. So the geometrical meaning of the The geometrical meaning of the algebra, of the hypersurface deformation algebra, is twofold. So there is one part which is 3D diffeomorphisms, if those are symmetries, and which is essentially this part here, the first bracket, is just saying that these are symmetries which are nicely represented on field space. And two, which is the most important part, and this is the part associated to H, is V. Refoliation invariants of spacetime. So I will unpack this statement little by little in what follows. This statement is not special to GR. So here I've written V and H on the ADM phase space, but a priori I could think of having a scalar field theory and still want to formulate it in a refoliation invariant way. And this is what Dirac was doing when he discovered this algebra for the first time. And in that case, V and H would be written on the scalar field space. So it wouldn't be functionals of h and pi as canonically conjugate variables, but rather of pi and its momentum, and probably h as well, but as a background quantity. So gr, but to any theory formulated in a refoliation invariant manner. Way. The typical example is the parametrized scalar field of Dirac. So this is, as I said last time, this is a generalization to scalar fields of the parametrized particle. The ideas are very similar, except that now coordinates play the role of the fake time. Like these affine parameters this parameter along the trajectory was arbitrary and so on. And it wasn't the actual time that we usually use. Here we introduce coordinates with similar properties that they're not the Minkowski coordinates, they're just some coordinates, and I want to be able to reshuffle them. Yes.
So the idea is that we'll get the same algebra but maybe a different Hamiltonian?
No. Yes, different generator. So in this case, V and H would be functions of little pi and phi, the canonical coordinate over my scalar field space. With hij as a background structure. I don't want to call it a field because it's not part of field space. It's just given. I'm not giving a dynamics to spacetime. Spacetime is what it is. I'm just parametrizing it in arbitrary foliation. Dirac was studying Minkowski space, arbitrarily foliated. So these hijs are just background quantities that are thrown in. Yeah.
So we can picture this refoliation, like I'm picturing really these, just taking different slices that are all still horizontal in a sense.
Yeah, so.
They're still moving always forward in time and they're all spatial slices.
Exactly, but they're arbitrary. So I want to say that the typical example is I want to go from here there, so this is time, this is sigma t1, this is sigma t0. And I can do this maybe in two possible ways, going through this intermediate slice or this other intermediate slice. And so this is generated by h of n, for example. So n is the length of these vectors, in a sense. And this one, and this one is generated by H of M. And I want, just a second, and I want these to be consistent. So for example, if I evolve first by H of N and then by H of M, or vice versa, I have to end up on the same final foliation. Maybe it turns out up to a spatial diffeomorphism. That is what this last equation tells me.
Those two intermediate slices that you drew, are those like fully spatial, just a two different?
Yeah, no, these are just other, it's just sigma t prime and sigma t double prime. Yes.
So when you just said up to a diffeomorphism, it means we end up on the same sigma, but just kind of maybe a bit kind of twisted. I mean, the points can be slightly, yeah.
Yeah. So my drawing is pretty.
It's the same surface.
Yes. My drawing is kind of bad. It's hard to draw decently, but suppose that I've done first h of n here. And in the other case, I've done first h of m. So let me draw it in orange. But then I do the other one next, h of n. So here is bigger. No, is this one bigger there? I mean, the drawing is really not particularly nice. Here h of m is bigger, so it ends up being this guy. Now, the point is I should draw this somehow like this and like that. And commuting them, doing them in the opposite order. Of course, if these are infinitesimal, here they look finite, but what I'm looking is the limit of them being infinitesimal. The only difference is this v of z. And in fact, this is how you can construct the algebra in the first place, just by looking at different foliations and studying how these h of like these translations in the normal direction commute with respect to each other, and you end up on that algebra. So nothing to do with GR, the scalar theory, and so on. This is like translation symmetries. It's an abstract thing that exists no matter which theory you look at. And then you look at the generators of this symmetry, and in GR they look like this, so that their Poisson bracket give the right algebra. In a scalar field theory, they would look different. They would be functions of phi and pi, pi the pi of the scalar field, and they would still give the right algebra. In that case, this h would be a background quantity that is not part, the bracket with h would be zero. I'm just interested in the brackets between phi and pi. Pi and little pi. Does that compute? A symmetry is a symmetry. Translation symmetry is what it is, no matter which theories I'm trying to implement it on. Here is the same. This refoliation invariant is what is encoded in that algebra. The generators, so generators of rotations, translations, and so on, are components of the stress energy tensor. Here, in GR, these generators are those.
Can I just ask why would we be surprised if it weren't if it didn't have refoliation invariants?
So you can
just saying, you know, I can, like in everyday life, I take this intermediate step and then go further, or I
don't. Yeah. So the point is how the theory is formulated. So for a scalar field, for example, usually we write things in Minkowski coordinates, which are like Cartesian coordinates. And everything relies on that in a sense. There's not even the possibility of writing these things on a priori, like in the standard formulation of a scalar field theory. It's not that it's not refoliation, the theory would not be refoliation invariant when written properly, but in the usual Hamiltonian formulation, you don't have enough structure to write this. You're just implicitly taking straight slices, and that's it. And you're looking, your time evolution is a step of Minkowski time, one step ahead, the same everywhere. Here we are allowing to go. Here you go up by this, here you go up by that, and the slice is not even R3. It's, well, topologically R3, but with a weird metric on it. So you just need to rewrite your theory in an appropriate way. And then, if it is a spacetime theory, a covariant spacetime theory, for sure you should be able to find a way in which you have refoliation invariant. From the fourth dimensional perspective, it's not surprising at all. It's just that you're just trying to do it. You need to give enough flexibility to your Hamiltonian theory to be able to do it, but it's not surprising that you can do it, I would say. So Dirac was just warming up to understanding Hamiltonian general relativity in the attempt to start quantizing it. And he started with the exercise of looking at the scalar field. But he needed to rewrite the Hamiltonian version of the scalar field in this more flexible way that has not been done before.
Okay.
in GR, what is special is that, and is that when you're, that this H is part of your field space. This is the true technical difference, which is actually crucial between GR and any other theory. This constant here, this geometric quantity that enters this algebra, is now part of your field space. For a scalar field, this is just something that it's external. It's not part of your canonical variables.
If this is too far off track, we can skip it. But I was just wondering if you sort of work with like the Palatini formulation instead, where you have tetrads and the connection, like the connection enter into the algebra in a weird way, or is it is it just the tetrads?
We will write it later and this afternoon. So
I think it's usually the right side that's stuck.
That's stuck? Oh, yeah, you're right. Yes, thanks. It helps. We will write it this afternoon. So the connection essentially replaces the extrinsic curvature. And the metric is replaced by the tetrad. Nope. Aha. Well, we will not use this one. Okay. It's not my problem anymore. So, remark two. The hypersurface deformation algebra is closely related to four-dimensional diffeomorphism invariants. But it is not the algebra of four diffeos. Or the diffeomorphism. So eventually, we know that on shell and so on, these two things must talk to each other. But this is not the algebra of four-dimensional diffeomorphism. It's not an algebra at all, in fact. The algebra of diffeomorphism looks like this. You cannot implement transverse diffeomorphisms as Hamiltonian symmetries on the ADM phase space. So the 3+1 split has important consequences. So we are splitting not just the metric and the degrees of freedom, but also the symmetries, as we wrote somewhere there. Normal diffeos are not Hamiltonian symmetries. And their action is replaced, in quotes. I don't know what replaced technically means, but instead of four diffeos, what we have is the flow of Hn. So you remember in the parametrized particle, we had a very similar situation. We had reparametrization invariants of the word line. And then we had a constraint associated to that, but it wasn't quite generating that reparametrization invariant. It was this Hamiltonian constraint that was generating the dynamics. So here, the same trade-off is happening. So we have C and H, which do basically the same thing. So here, compare with parametrized particle, where reparametrization invariants invariance, which is a 1D differ in the normal direction, if you think about it. Is graded for the flow of the constraint. We had call it C, which we also identified back then with the dynamics, in fact. So here we expect virtually the same structure. So at this high level, the two, the Hamiltonian constraint is precisely like the constraint in the parameterized particle that. And this is my. Oh, I thought I had a remark about this. I will come back to it a bit later. So we will come back to this example later. So, yeah, there is this trade-off happening, and they're not quite the same, but they do similar things in a sense. And the magic, which we'll now see, is that the fact that we have replaced four diffeos by this weird stuff is actually a positive thing if we look at it from a constructive point of view of general relativity. So this is where there is a theorem by, I mean, I call it a theorem, it's just not written as such, it's a result, but maybe result. Let's see. Teitelbaum in 73, I think I've uploaded this paper, it's very readable, it's actually super nice. He says that the only consistent way to implement the hypersurface deformation algebra on the ADM phase space requires V, maybe I can write it, is curly V equals 0 and H equals 0. And this is ultimately due, which are just h and v, the integrants instead of the integrals. This is ultimately due to the dependence of z on h. And then he observes the following. When V and H are both 0, this tells us two things. Well, let's keep one for now. The flow of HN can be interpreted as reconstructing a spacetime. So what am I trying to say here? Like in Young-Mills, only the data that satisfies the Gauss constraint can be initial values for the evolution. Here, similarly, I need to be at h equals 0 and v equals 0 to be able to interpret the flow of h as a four-dimensional geometry. And a flow of h is what? Is a series of geometries on sigmas. So these, I can really think of them now as being a series of stacked geometry one on top of each other, and they stack nicely to form a four-dimensional geometry. And the refoliation invariance tells me that it doesn't matter how I get to this third the geometry on top, I can evolve it in different ways and always get to the, and I would always get to this.
So, but there are no, what are the conditions or assumptions in this result?
They're very weak. You just, you really, the point is that, let me think a second how it's done. You essentially want to say, you really want to implement that picture. If you say evolving H for HM and HN in different orders gives you these. So you say, okay, commuting these two gives me just a spatial difference, which depends on H. Now I can compare. It's a bit tricky to phrase, but it's very simple. And in a sense, you say, now I compare the action of these differs on my geometries. And you observe that in one case, H is inside. So you're basically looking at Jacobi here. So you have two parentheses in effect. So, and then the second one hits on H. And by looking at that picture and interpreting right, you see that to be able, and interpreting right means that you have a four-dimensional geometry underneath. Then in one case of computing things, you hit on the H, and in the other, you don't. So the only way for these two things to be equal is that you are on shell of, that this is zero, in fact. Because otherwise, there would be, you can show that there is a difference due to hitting on this H. For example, for the evolution of pi, which has bracket 1 with this H. So you can just pick one variable and see that it to make it evolve consistently. And then, since V must be 0, but V must be 0 on every single slice, but being 0 on every single slice, it means that evolving V by H must give 0. So also this must be 0. And then H must be 0 as well. So it's the way Teitelbaum works his way is really taking seriously that picture, which is a space-time picture. So he says, look, if we want to have this refoliation, space-time refoliation picture, the only way to do it consistently or on this phase space, because it's important that H is part of phase space in this argument, is that V and H are. So it's a bit convoluted, but in fact, it's not that complicated once you understand the logic.
So, but then this whole statement seems to be a statement about something, the idiom for foliation of the space-time. It has nothing to do with what theory we are looking at.
No, it depends. So here, to make the argument,
you need
H to be part of your phase space.
Okay, so for for the generators, this statement holds, right? It's for the GR case.
For GR case, yeah. This is really relying on that. So because it ultimately depends that this is, in a sense, this is not the best notation. it's not a point in P, but it's a coordinate on P. It's a part of phase space. So what you care is that hij with something is not zero. This is what you really care. Yes?
And just overall, this philosophy of making this 3+1 split, is it motivated by like interpretation of time as something special, or is it just something we want, and now we're saying all of these things to say it works.
So remember, we started from the covariant picture in space-time with this covariant symplectic structure and so on. And we said, if we want to understand the usual Hamiltonian dynamics, like in terms of evolution of something, we need to look at these slices. There it was boundaries. So we're kind of, in fact, it's a very natural thing to do mathematically because your symplectic covariant symplectic structure is not really a symplectic structure on spacetime. It really wants to be integrated on a surface because it's a three form, not a four form. So it's kind of pushing you to go in this direction. And one reason why you sort of have to do it in GR is because of the following. Basically, this is a description. So remember when I said a bit vaguely that F on shell with omega is the phase space? So when you want to quantize, you need the phase space to, you're quantizing a symplectic space, a phase space with the Poisson bracket. So if you want to realize this explicitly, this is super abstract. It's just a space of solutions of some equations. But if you want to try to realize this explicitly, the easiest way for any theory is to go on the boundary and try to find the good initial data, and which is what we're doing here. And so for GR, you end up on this thing, that there's no, yeah. Maybe one should be smarter and try not to do it and do things differently. But if we follow what we did for any other theory, we really end up here. So I'm just following the steps that I followed for scalar fields, Young-Mill theory. I'm redoing them for GR, and this is where we are led.
I guess I would say, because you could do the same thing on a Euclidean theory with like radial evolution instead, it's not really the like time component of like the signature is 3+1. It's more just like we picked a direction to evolve as we're looking at.
Yeah, there are differences in the Euclidean and Lorentzian theory. So, but roughly speaking, the idea of going to the boundary would all true in both. The difference is that in a Lorentzian theory, you put data on the initial surface and not also on the final one. So in a sense, the boundary of this, you need just half of the boundary of spacetime, whereas in the Euclidean, you would have just one boundary. Like there are some, and this is because some equations are hyperbolic, the other are elliptic, and so they have different properties. So let me just compute this. So here we said we have ADM, we have those V and those H that represent our symmetries, and if you want to implement the symmetries, then we need them to be constraints. Now one can ask, is there an analog of Lovelock theorem in this Hamiltonian picture, which is GR unique somehow? Why we have this weird Hamiltonian over here? Could we put something else and still find something consistent? The answer is no. So this is Ojman, Kukash, and Teitelbaum. And this is also uploaded on the portal. They say that modulo minor technical details, a bit like in Lovelock theorem, you need to assume some, I don't know, that things are quadratic in the derivative, so probably here quadratic in pi, things like this. Modulo minor technical assumptions the functional form of star. So again, it's about on ADM, on the ADM phase space, is unique. So this is, before we say that diffeos fix GR completely, here is the HDA fixes GR completely. Once we choose, we declare, in a sense, that hij, which appears in the algebra, is one of our canonical variables. of our two canonical variables. So these, even they say it very explicitly, they interpret these as an Hamiltonian version of Lovelock theorem. Oops, bad idea. Okay. Finally, I wanted to say one thing about the physical interpretation, and then that's it. Physical So we said already a lot, in fact, but just to iterate certain points. Point one is the fact that since Vx generates 3D fields, the implementation of this constraint means that 3D diffeos are pure gauge. And therefore, the objects of GR's general relativity's dynamics, 3 plus 1 dynamics, let's say, are in quote abstract free geometries. So they're not, it's not the dynamics of a spin to field for real, it's the dynamic of the geometry itself. What matters is not which metric you choose, but just the shape of the surface. So this thing is so this is one calls this geometrodynamics. Which is which says that which unfolds over what is often called superspace. So if you read this name in a paper, what is meant is usually the space of matrix, of 3D matrix, so Riemannian matrix on sigma, so Hij, modulo 3D diffeos. So is the space of three geometries. So this is, so in a sense, the you can think of evolution of a particle as happening in field space, in phase space, sorry, in the space of the P's and Q's. For GR, it happens in this space, in this superspace. So this was the way Wheeler was really pushing for these ideas and trying to make sense of them.
What was RIEM? What is super?
Oh, RIEM, Riemannian structures on sigma. So it's the space of three metrics. So an element is a three metric. So and this geometrodynamics is generated. And is generated by HN, by
this flow.
The arbitrarily, N can be chosen arbitrarily, which is the arbitrariness in the choice of foliation. as we said, although this is technically way more challenging, to deal with, let's say abstractly, the HN is analogous to C, which we wrote like this for the parameterized particle. What are the main differences? Those that is worth really noticing. First of all, N of X has no analog. In the parameterized particle case. And the reason is that this parameterized particle, because that is a 0 plus 1 field theory. So there is just no place to put this x, essentially. So you can multiply this by 12, by 13. You would always get similar constraints. Here, you can multiply by a function on the slice. So what is the physical interpretation of this nx? Is the rate of clicking of a lousy clock, we could say, at position x. So the beautiful thing of GR is that we can use lousy clocks and rods to do physics. We don't need the clocks that ticks properly. We can use any rotten old clock, and we can still make sense of physics, which is quite remarkable. And so here is the choice of one such broken clock. The second important difference is that in GR, we do not have a privileged time variable. Which technically, it means that H is not, it cannot be written. People tried a long time, but it doesn't, nobody ever found a good solution to this problem. So I would just state, cannot be written as some p for some time plus some little h of some other. So this split of degrees of freedom into p's and q's and t's, and it doesn't work. So there's no, and here the important thing is that this is linear. So in some time tau, like some time operator tau. And not. So the point is that this doesn't work. Some privileged time So this is the momentum conjugate to some privileged time variable. And this cannot be done. So this, of course, has important consequences for the quantization. Even at the formal level. I'm not even talking about the rigorous quantization, but even at the formal level. In the sense that you remember from this one, quantizing it, we found the Schrödinger equation, and we were able to recover the usual interpretation of the Schrödinger equation. If you But that relied very strongly on the linearity of C in P. So here you have something relativistic, so you don't expect it to be linear, but this causes problems because the Klein-Gordon equation, for example, doesn't really have an easy probabilistic interpretation. You need to go to a field theory to make it work, but then everything changes. Like there's a big jump. And so it's kind of unclear how to make sense of these things. And it could be simply that quantum gravity, the unitarity, so which depends on like these probability conservations and so on, might be only an approximate result that holds only in certain regimes where some preferred time emerges naturally somehow. But this, of course, you have to prove it case by case, and so it becomes hard. So in cosmology, this is usually studied in cosmology, where one doesn't study the full problem, but just reduces to the space of, I don't know, FRW metrics or maybe Bianchi metrics and so on. So one has just a finite number of degrees of freedom and tries to quantize it. Okay, I think this took a bit more time than expected. So let me just write it because it's cute. So this is the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, where you replace, like the Wheeler-DeWitt equation technique, you replace formally these pi's with functional derivatives in H. So it's just the Schrodinger quantization of this equation.
Yeah.
So
if we take the space of metrics, the FRW metrics plus the anisotropic Bianchi models or whatever, that we have a privileged time based on the symmetry of the model.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what you said, this is how people try to quantize these spaces. And
in that case, you have a much simpler problem to deal with. But certain aspects certain problems survive. For example, the fact that is quadratic in the momenta, if I remember properly, it survives in any mini superspace model. So you would still have issues of unitarity. So usually what you do is to take somehow a square root of that. And when you change branch of the square root is when the scale factor, for example, changes sign or something. So it goes through zero. That's a Big Bang in principle. So on each branch, you might have a decent probabilistic interpretation, but not across the Big Bang. So you have and what about if the Big Bang is resolved by some mechanism? So it's a big industry. I don't know. I cannot give a summary of the results. There are different approaches, different ideas. But that's roughly the idea, is to simplify the kinematics as much as possible to deal with something that is. So in that case, even if you have a privileged time, in a sense, you still have the problem that this is quadratic. So yeah, you try to solve one problem at a time or approach one problem at a time.
So in this equation, what is the interpretation of psi?
Oh, psi is a function. So here, good point. So psi is morally a psi of H. I say morally in the sense that I'm not defining the space in which this lives rigorously, but is some L2 of something like of that sort, and pi, so H acts by multiplication, and pi acts by functional derivative. So is I times maybe I h bar times d over dh. Something of this sort. And if I just write that, of course, there are huge problems of operator ordering here, because these contractions depend on the metric. There is a determinant of the metric. So this is very formal. It's operator orderings. So one big problem one has in any model of GR is to, I quantize my space, I regularize my operators. Then I have to find an operator ordering which does not destroy this algebra. Because you know, depending on in which order you put your creation annihilation operators, you spit out ones, which would make this algebra anomalous. So you would break your gauge symmetry. And so the toy is broken completely. It's not that it's recoverable. And that's a big challenge, in fact, very often, especially when you're dealing with things that are this complicated.
Maybe this is not the right way to think about it, but I'm just very confused now by this picture I have in mind of a three metric, and I'm interested in the dynamics of overall, it's still a four D metric. Like at the end of the day, I want to understand a 4D metric.
Mm-hmm.
So if I've done this split and I'm just looking at H and let's say also fix some arbitrary parameterization of time, like how do I, at the end of the day, then get to something
mm-hmm. okay.
where the first component can maybe also change and it's not.
So that's a good point. I haven't been very explicit how you write a four-dimensional metric out of this three-dimensional data. So the way in a four-dimensional space-time, you can think of diffeomorphisms as changing your pushing you around space-time, right? So if you have a four vector, you can think of it as a translation that takes you from one point to another. So these is moving you along the slice, and this is moving you in between slices. So now, if in your space of 3D metrics, you act with a sequence of these V and H's, it gives you a sequence of three metrics related by a specific x and n. And so somehow you don't only have the metric on the slice, but you also know in which direction you're moving, in a sense. So you need the x and n are part of your reconstruction procedure. You see what I'm trying to say? So are those arrows. They tell you which arrows you're using in that diagram. Now, just last bit is that these are, however, gauge symmetries in some sense. So it doesn't matter when you go from one slice to the other which sequence of x and n you use as long as you end up on the same slice. So this is what this algebra is telling you, that to build a metric, you need some n and x, some, the four-dimensional one. You need some choice of n and x, but you can do it as you please, because in the end, it doesn't really matter up to diffeomorphism.
And I guess maybe even though we have the split, that's how at the end of the day we get space and time mixing again, because you choose some h of m, h of n, and for that you get a sequence of h's, but because of this psi thing, you can then repackage that into a different choice of...
Exactly. Okay. You can go through a different series of slices, and you would obtain, if you land on the same final slice, of course, you would end up with the same result, with the same three geometry. So it means that it doesn't really matter how I have split my space-time in between the two, as long as I end up on the same one at the end. So it's a gauge it's an evolution along gauge somehow, because I'm using these gauge symmetries to build my four-dimensional space-time. But since what I'm interested in the space of geometries up to diffeomorphisms, everything is consistent again, because it doesn't matter anymore which particular gauge path I've used. So it's hard to see. I think it's a bit funny to pinpoint in your head. It's not straightforward at all. Because it's this mixture of symmetries and dynamics all mixed in one thing, and reconstructing space-time. So it's really a lot happening all at once. Yes.
So is the way we should think about it like GIJ? By Hij, G0i is given by x,
n,
and G00
yeah.
is given but
I think that's pretty much. So in your, you can split your metric G mu nu, well, GAB as I've been calling it, in H essentially, some G zero zero, which is N square, and some N XI over here. But this is coordinate dependent, this writing. So the choice of coordinates allows you to change the n and size, and this is why there are gauge symmetries here. But you cannot avoid choosing some to write down your four metric. So this is the trade-off. You need some choice to write down the metric, but in the end, the choice, to a large extent, should not be relevant. It's not that it's completely relevant, but to a very large extent, it's not relevant. And this is how all these things kind of hold together. And it's amazing that they hold together nicely only for the GR dynamics. And this is something I cannot picture. It's just, I don't know, a remarkable fact. So these extra theorems are actually very, very powerful, very constraining.
So if like we consider any modification to GR, none of this would work.
Sorry?
If we consider GR action to be instead of just Ricci scalar, we consider Ricci scale, some Gauss Bonnet or something.
Yeah, if you add the higher power of the Riemann tensor, you will have higher derivative theories.
Mm-hmm.
And here I'm looking just the second order theories, because these things are, I have just one coordinate, one momenta, and things are quadratic. So I think one would have to redo the analysis from, as we discussed, I think, some time ago, from scratch. But these theorems pinpoint that GR is the only second order equation theory, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to go too much over time for Lauren. We meet again this afternoon, so we can. If you have questions, maybe.